Outrageous Tarrington. Okay. What I'm going to talk about this morning is to try to give you a little bit of background as to why we have this particular problem, a little bit about nature itself, some of the laws of nature, and in a sense, ecology. This is really what ecology is, trying to understand plants and animals, how they live together in what we call communities. And perhaps failure to recognize some of the basic laws of nature really has resulted in the problem that we're in today. And I'd like to bring out some of these basic principles, and perhaps you can better understand what's going on. First off, principles of ecology, that plants and animals live together. And this refers to not only each other, but also the environment. In other words, it's them in relation to their environment. And what we have then is them living together in what we call a community. And in other words, all supposedly in balance. And when we get out of balance, this is when we have problems, and that man is creating, in a sense, an imbalance. So for best type of life, and otherwise we have then this community life in which the life is, in a sense, balanced. True, there's change going on. In other words, animals born, live, die, and so on, but there's recycling, and within this change, there is a balanced condition. And if you get imbalanced, then you result in real problems. So basically, then, there should be a sense of balance within this community. We use the term ecosystem for this whole thing of all these, everything all interrelated. It's extremely complex. And that we have everything interacting, the environment, we have the people, animals, plants, all interacting together. And some of the principles of this community type of life, or the ecosystem, would be, first off, interdependence. No organism is completely self-sufficient. There's all interdependencies among one another. In other words, we're dependent upon plants and animals for food. Plus also for oxygen, plants give us oxygen. All these things in nature we find, there are cycles, they recycle, and we are extremely interdependent upon one another. And this is perhaps one of the problems. If we take out a link in this very complex chain of interdependencies, then, you see, maybe you wouldn't miss a few mosquitoes or something, but if we were to completely block out, remove all the annoying insects, then you would find there would be vast things happening. In other words, some other organism eats these, and then that would be harmed, and therefore then something else eats this, and you see you could have a sort of a chain effect to a certain extent. So there is this interdependence. All the organisms are interdependent, and even in our human society there's a certain amount of interdependence. How many of you could live very long if you are completely, quote, self-sufficient? In other words, somebody, where do you get your car from, or even how do you build your house, and so on, or even lumber, in other words, you chop down the trees, and otherwise. So there's interdependence here. Another very important thing is competition. Competition for survival. This would be competition among species of the same kind and also different species. Competition is absolutely essential. We find that nature puts forth many more seeds than could possibly survive. And, for example, just look at the pollen that's produced in some of these pine trees out here, just copious quantities. Or maybe you've been here in June and you've seen all this wafting snow-like stuff. It's the cottonwood. Those are seeds. Can you imagine how many cottonwood trees we have around here if every one of those germinated and grew? Well, there'd be no room for Holden Village or anything else. The same thing, the number of seeds for trees produced, or the number of seeds for weeds, or otherwise you wonder that anything else survives. So there are many more produced than can possibly survive. Even the queen bee, for example, the number of eggs she lays is simply fantastic in the course of time. And so many more are produced and could possibly survive. So we have this competition factor. What does survive? Supposedly those that are best fit for the particular environment that we have. And another very important thing is variability. We find that organisms do vary with respect to characteristics. Some can survive in one kind of environment. If the environment changes slightly, then something else survives. This has been extremely important and has been a source of one of our problems. In using insecticides, we use a certain dosage and it kills most of the insects, but there are a few that are different. Why? Because of this variability factor, and they survive. And their offspring, you see, also are variable and have the same resistance. And what have we got? We've got a whole race of insects that are resistant to what we've been using. So what do we have to do? We up the dosage. And then we kill most of those, but not all of them, because again, there's this variation factor, and some still aren't killed. And then all those reproduce, all those that were susceptible have long since been dead, and all we've got is a race of resistant insects. So then we have to continue to up the dose, and you see the problem here. And same thing has been true in antibiotics. We, in our control of bacterial diseases, you use a certain antibiotic, and there are a few that survive. And then you've got a whole race of bacteria that is resistant to that particular antibiotic, and it's no better than an aspirin pill, or even less useful. So then what do you have to do? You use another antibiotic. But again, you see, the same problem of variability, but this is one of the basic principles of nature, is meant survival. Because if all organisms were the same, we would long since have been gone. But this factor of variability has enabled survival in the past. But it's rather interesting. You can see what's happening as far as use of insecticides. And then I'll further bring about one of the problems that results. But I'd like to first emphasize a few more principles of ecology. So basically, in this community,
are you saying that if you eliminate the organisms that can't take the antibiotic or the pesticide, that reduces the competition? In other words, that the weak mosquitoes keep the resistant mosquitoes for a long time?
No, normally, without the use of an antibiotic or a pesticide, it isn't necessarily that those that are susceptible to the pesticide are weaker. Not necessarily. It's all that... Okay, sensitive versus resistant. Okay, normally, without the use of a pesticide, you'd have a population probably would be mostly susceptible insects because they've never been exposed to this thing. But once you introduce it, it wipes out the susceptible, so all you've got left are the resistant ones.
Now my question is the fact that all the susceptible ones are dead make it easier for the others to multiply?
Yes, definitely so. Right. And so that's all you've got left because their competition. Again, you've got competition here. That's all wiped out. So again, these take over. Okay, some other factors of importance in this. In this community, these particular interrelationships, we also find that in nature we have cycles. And nature recycles things. They don't produce a waste, and then what do we do with it? And this is one of the problems with man. Again, we don't recycle our things, but in nature, these things are recycled. For example, nitrogen. We have a basic nitrogen cycle. Animal wastes are changed by bacteria, ultimately into nitrates that plants utilize to produce protein. Animals eat the plants, and then the waste would be the urea, ammonia. Again, bacteria transform it into nitrates and plants. It's just a regular cycle in which all the nitrogen is reused. It isn't blocked up and not utilized. And the same thing is true with carbon. So we have these basic cycles, these things continually reused and recycled, rather than, okay, here we've got a dump of bottles and we can't reuse them, so they just pile up. But nature, things don't pile up. If there were no bacteria, they could, conceivably. But you know, in a forest, trees fall down in the course of time, fungus and bacteria cause decay, these things go back into the soil and are recycled. So there's never this accumulation factor that we have. Another thing, when we introduce things now into this particular system, some of them are not easily disposed of. For example, here's where DDT comes in. It has a so-called half-life of a long, it has a long half-life, meaning that it's with us for a considerable amount of time. What does this mean? That first it cycles through the atmosphere, and then it's taken up by organisms. And another thing, it is not, it enters into the system, it's not broken down, it's not discharged. So what happens, it tends to become stored within the organism, and is stored, tends to be localized in the fatty tissue. Okay, supposing even you are never near any DDT, you will still have a level of DDT in your body because of the principle that it, we know that the air circulates around the complete Earth in about 15 to 25 days. So even if you had a big blast of DDT in New York City, it will circle the Earth. So we find high levels of DDT even way up in the Arctic where DDT is never used. Okay, also another basic principle which hinges on this is in fact what we call a food chain, which I just basically mentioned before, that we find that organisms are dependent upon other organisms for food, and there are various levels on this food chain. The lowest level would be the producers, and the producers are fundamentally green plants. So we could put here green plants. Without photosynthesis, there would be no life whatsoever. You might think, well, I could care less if I ate any vegetables or green things. But nevertheless, this is the fundamental source of all life, because green plants produce food from energy, which is the sun. And the sun's energy is continuous. And as long as we have sun's energy, we would have this potential, assuming we don't upset it, which could be a possibility. But green plants, then, are the fundamental producers. And if this is a pyramid type of thing in which the lowest level has to be the largest. Usually the people, the organisms that eat then these only get 10% of it. In other words, so we have to have really 90 tons more of this, you see, because this second level can only utilize 10% of the energy produced by the green plants. And then every level up, successive level, it's a, you see, they only get 10% of the previous. So if this were 100 calories, this would only get 10 calories out of that. All right, so you have your green plants. Above this would be perhaps herbivores, the animals that eat plants. Then would be the carnivores, the animals that eat the animals, or so on. And on up, well, man is at the top of the pyramid, you see. And so the earth can support very little of man compared to the amount of green plants you have to have in comparison. All right, supposing now we get DDT into the food chain here at the very bottom, algae in the ocean or in salt water, or actually fresh water. What happens then? We've got fish that eat the algae, and they will take up the DDT that's present in the oily portion of the cell, and it will then, it isn't discharged, it just isn't metabolized, it would remain within these fish. So they would have a higher level of DDT than would the algae. Then birds, then maybe some fish would eat those fish, you see, and they will accumulate even more DDT. Then maybe you have maybe a few other links, but finally you'll get to some birds that eat the fish, that have eaten the fish, that have eaten the algae. And they will have much higher level than either way. And there's some actual studies that have been carried on with respect to this, and I could give you just a little idea. These were taken in levels of DDT parts per million, and we find that at the marsh plants, some of the plants then that were fed upon had a level of DDT, well, marsh plants were 0.33, plankton 0.04, very low level, 0.04. Then the marsh plants would be 0.33. Okay, now what about some of the organisms now? Here's some fish, 0.23. You see, it's going up from the 0.04.
billfish 2.07 and some other fishes 1.24, something like that. Well, now the interesting thing is when we get to some of the birds, and specifically terns have a 6.4, osprey 13.8, mergans are 22.8, cormorant 26.4, gulls up to 75 parts per million. So you see there can be an accumulation, and the most dangerous you see are the carnivores at the top of the food chain. Here there's just a very low level, and even a lower level in the sea itself, but you see it becomes accumulated, concentrated, and then here.
Just on hand, then, would it be better for us to eat plants?
Yes, it would be better to eat algae than it would to eat animals that have eaten this and this and this, because this would be easier to get accumulate your levels of DDT here. So this is one of the frightening things you see, and we know that DDT does cause harm. In birds, for example, several of our birds are becoming extinct because of high levels of DDT. Results in failure in reproduction, thinning of the shell and such. And when we do have extinction, then we've got other problems. Let's bring out what some of these can be. Pardon me? Right. Liver? Yes, and also liver apparently concentrates a lot of toxins. You think of liver as being something good to eat, you know, because of the iron. But we may have to re-evaluate this in the future because liver concentrates a good many of these toxins. The highest levels in studies they made was in the fatty tissue, blubber or fatty tissue.
Is it in milk too? If you wanted to stay away from DDT, could you get your protein from sheep and things like that?
No, I think you'd find that it would be in the fat of milk too.
Well, if you got the
no
fat?
This would certainly be better. But then you've got other problems too. When you try to limit your diet, trying to stay away from something, then you may be in more trouble than if you eat a balanced diet.
The important thing is the balance, isn't it?
Yeah, right, because once you break off this balance, then you're in trouble. And we can see if certain organisms become extinct, then you've got problems because they're essential, you see, in this food chain, nature. Then we've got other problems. And as Leo said this morning, any complex problem, if you look at it correctly, is even more complex than it appears even on the surface. But one other little thing about the DDT, we also find that DDT reduces photosynthesis. And we know there is DDT present in the algae, the fundamental producers in the ocean. And so it has even been hypothesized that within the future 10, 20 years, our ocean could, quote, die because of, you see, accumulation here. And decreased photosynthesis rather than, as we would hope, increased.
What do you think of that prediction?
I think it's a little rash, but I do believe there will be a significant, perhaps, change in our oceans, yes, unless we have a significant change in what's going on. The future, it could be rather frightening if you consider all of these aspects. But this is one thing as far as DDT. Let me mention an imbalance that occurs in nature and let's see what happens when it does occur. This is one that has naturally occurred, and it's called the red tide. Any of you familiar with it? If you lived on the coast of California, you'd be familiar with it. Florida coast, Gulf coast. You usually find it in warmer waters. And it's becoming more frequent than it has in the past, which is rather interesting. I'll mention why. The red tide occurs usually in the fall when the water is warmest. But what it requires, apparently, is warm water plus an influx of fresh water bringing certain nutrients in. What happens? There's a certain organism. It's called a dinoflagellate. And rather interesting-looking organism. Looks like it has a coat of armor otherwise. And it has a couple of flagella, and sort of armored here. At any rate, what happens When the conditions become ripe, this thing begins to reproduce, and for some reason or other, it takes over like a weed and can very successfully compete against all other plankton. And it's in other words, you need a microscope to see it. So this thing, such that a teaspoon of water would have billions, you see, of these tiny, tiny organisms. And during the red tide, the water looks sort of murky due to the great abundance of these. And then, also accompanied with this, you will notice an odor of dead fish. Well, what has happened is these things are taking over so much that they use up some of the oxygen, or a good deal of it, meaning that the other organisms are oxygen-starved, plus they produce a toxic substance, and you have mass death of fish and other organisms. And this is the so-called red tide.
Now, pardon me, is that in any relation to the, I don't think this is on the West Coast, but when we were in Florida, we saw a lot of the man-o-war, is that what they call it? That has the tentacles down in there.
That's a jellyfish. That's something different. That would be visible. Right. But these are, you couldn't see them unless you looked at them under the microscope. And it's just a murky color to the water. And at night, these are bioluminescent. In other words, they glow when you agitate the water. So you can even walk on the sand and you can write your name on the sand. You know, it glows. It's a beautiful thing to behold, actually, if you can see. At night, you see when the waves break, then you see all this blue phosphorescence. But it's a rather interesting phenomenon of imbalance, you see, in what happens. And it results in mass death, you see, when one organism takes over.
Is man responsible for that imbalance?
Not entirely, but there does seem to be an influence here, because it is the influx of water into the ocean, and apparently it occurs, and this water is bringing in certain substances, among them iron, vitamin B12, and tannic acid, apparently stimulate the growth of these organisms. And it could be, you see, again, there may be an influence of dumping things in, and bacteria then, bacterial action in harbors then cause the conversion into vitamin B12 and then the iron. So there, because there is a definite increase in the, I think in Florida, for example, there was one in 1916, another in 32, another in 46, then 52, 53, and almost every year thereafter. So there is a definite increase. And then, of course, but then another problem is man thinks, okay, now we'll build some dams to prevent the water from going in. And this is another one of our problems. Okay, we create one problem, then to try to correct it, we create a bigger problem, you see. You know, if you build dams, then you will upset not just this one area, but perhaps many areas, and it's not easily repaired. He mentioned some other aspects. We spoke a little bit about air, and Leo mentioned about air and the smog and such. We find that the levels of smog and the LA freeway are such that certain plants, lettuce, spinach, can't tolerate this level of smog. What happens? You can only grow certain things along the freeway. Secondly, the San Bernardino forest, now we find that many, many acres are being destroyed. The ponderosa pine is being destroyed because of the smog. And so if we, it's not only us, but it's our livelihood, you see. What happens then again, overpopulation, where do you put the people? You cut down the plants, and again you're decreasing this. And incidentally, plants produce the oxygen. If it were, there were no plants, you see, our oxygen supply might be a problem here too. Another interesting thing about soil. Soil is important as a, you know, for growing plants, and we find that throughout the United States and other parts of the world, we have certain types of soil. These types of soil will support certain types of plants, and we have to realize this and understand it and face the facts. There's a particular kind of soil called laterite. It's a red soil, and it occurs in tropical areas. If any of you have been in Georgia, area and seen the peach trees, you know, beautiful pink trees within this funny red soil. Well, it's a laterite. It has iron and aluminum oxides. It makes an excellent building material. You know, it makes fabulous bricks. But for cultivating, it isn't the best thing. And the purer your laterite is, the worse is it as far as cultivation is concerned. Well, the Army Corps of Engineers went into some of these tropical areas, chopped down all the vegetation that was there, decided, well, you know, what's the matter with these people? Why don't they grow corn and wheat like we do, you know, and improve the country a little. Well, anyhow, what they did was to chop down the existing vegetation and then try to cultivate the laterite. Well, it just doesn't work. You can grow perhaps 1 or 2 years of crops on laterite, but after that, you have used up any nutrients that are present, then exposing it to the atmosphere, then it just turns into a brick pavement, really, and it's unusable. But the only areas that laterite can be used for successful cultivation have been in the Mekong River Valley, where because of continual flooding, they have been, it continually renews, you see, a little veneer of nutrients in soil. So what happened? They've been able to cultivate there for year after year. Supposing now we go in and build a dam there to prevent this, quote, harmful flooding. Just something to think about. Anyhow, laterite then is a particular kind of soil. What can you do in it? The thing to do is to analyze, okay, what is growing in laterite soil, and why don't we capitalize on this kind of thing? True, there is vegetation in laterite soil. It takes a long, long time to develop. Apparently, nutrients are obtained through a what we call a symbiotic relationship between the roots of the trees type that you have and a fungus. It's a relationship, and the fungus supplies the nutrients. But once you chop down what was there, you destroy this fungus symbiosis, and you see it won't develop until you have the plants there for some time. So here's another little problem, which again, we're upsetting what was once there, trying to put what we think should be there. But nature pretty much tells you what should be there by what is already there. And in other words, our problem has been we haven't looked at nature, observed nature, and acted accordingly. Water, again, here's a problem of thermal pollution, heating up the water. Any water above 90 degrees Fahrenheit is going to be generally toxic to most organisms. Even heating up the water 10 degrees results in problems because the additional heat changes the life cycle of the organism, speeds it up considerably. Even with fruit fly, if you grow them at room temperature, they'll have a cycle of 15 days. If you grow them at a little above room temperature, usually about 7 degrees above that, you've got a cycle of 10 days. 15 days versus 10 days. So that's just a very few degrees Fahrenheit. Same thing with your fish. When you increase the temperature, you increase their metabolism, their life cycle. What does this mean? It means that they require more food when there's less food. And you see, you speed up everything. Now this is another little problem. So Leo mentioned a little bit about eutrophication. And I might elaborate just a bit on what this involves. We find that lakes have a life cycle just as people or other things. And we find that a young lake is one that is has relatively little as far as dead plant debris. It's a nice, clear, crystal lake that you could find in the higher Sierras where people haven't been, you know, and trout supports a certain amount of fish. It's usually a cold, clear lake. As the lake ages, you have more plants and stuff around the outside, they fall in, and gradually you have filling up of the lake. Well, man is speeding this natural process up tremendously by dumping or otherwise. What happens then, you've got your lake, it's being filled up by putting a bunch of organic materials in. What happens? Once you have organics, this is food for bacteria. It lands down at the bottom of your lake. The bacteria begin to act on this in producing decay. One of the byproducts would be carbon dioxide, among other things. And to cause this decay, oxygen is necessary. It's a respiration process. So what happens? Your lake then is depleted of oxygen necessary for the fish and otherwise, and discharges CO2. And you kill your lake, essentially. It ultimately, you see, gradually the accumulation of CO2 and others, hydrogen sulfide among others, and you see it's the gradual filling in. Well, this is a process that occurs normally, but it's something like 10,000 years, not 10 years or 100 years. And we have speeded up this process tremendously in the Great Lakes and in other lakes by dumping things in, which then act as in this particular process. Leo also mentioned something about these blooms. This refers to, again, an imbalance that results because we dump certain nutrients in, and you get then a vast number of algae, certain kinds of algae. And these then can again result in death of fish or other organisms. They may produce toxic substances, but at any rate, they starve the water of its nutrients by having an imbalance. Again, it's the same principle of imbalance here.
Back at the lake, there's a bacteria falling in.
No, first plant materials fall in. Okay. The natural process would be, okay, you get some weeds here and they fall in, and otherwise. It's a slow process at best. But if we dump things in, organic things, then we always have bacteria present. Then the more organics there are, the more bacteria, more food, more bacteria. And so then they all produce this carbon dioxide and perhaps toxic substances.
Are they getting the oxygen for carbon dioxide from the water?
No, all water. In other words, we have water here. Supposing it's a relatively clear lake, there will be an equilibrium between the oxygen in the atmosphere and the water. Water holds a certain percentage of oxygen. One other little factor as far as thermal pollution, the heating. When you heat up water, what happens? You lose your oxygen. And when the fish need it more because of the higher life cycle, they have less because heating water kicks out the oxygen. You have your maximum oxygen if the water is close to freezing. As you heat it up, this oxygen bubbles off. So there is an equilibrium between the oxygen in the atmosphere and in the water. If you have a pool of water that circulates, then you can get oxygen throughout. But in this process, in the stagnation process, it often happens in the summer when there isn't circulation. And then you get a stagnation at the bottom here where the stuff accumulates, the bacteria act, and you don't have enough influx of new oxygen, and you get anaerobic conditions down at the bottom. And this CO2 will accumulate. But some of it, of course, is going to come off to the atmosphere, some of the carbon dioxide, which is another problem in itself. Tremendous increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere within the past 100 years, because all our fossil fuels give off carbon dioxide, among other things. More people, more carbon dioxide, you see, that's our. And fewer plants. Plants use up the carbon dioxide, but when we chop down the plants, we have fewer plants. And again, one other problem, too, I might bring out. We have had a tendency to simplify the ecosystem or the community. In other words, we plant fields and fields and fields of corn. And there are some states that have nothing but corn and soybeans, maybe. Okay, fine. But this is a problem because it means that when you simplify the ecosystem, it is much easier for a parasite to wipe it all out when you have everything. It's a simplified type of ecosystem, and it's very easy to wipe out something. And this is why we have such a problem with some of the parasites. In certain cities in the Midwest, a loss of the elm tree, because there were so many, you see, they were all planted up and down, and there is actual contact. The roots contact each other, and even though if this tree has the disease, even though no matter what you do up top to this next tree, the roots contact, and this one gets it, and it goes all down the line, you see, because of you had the same thing. Whereas if you had a mixed forest, it would be much more difficult to for a parasite to take over and wipe everything out completely. So these are some other little things.
Would that be true with the jellyfish?
With the jellyfish? Yeah, that's specifically what I was thinking about. Right. Definitely true.
May I ask, can you use these reactor plants, thermal pollution doesn't have any effect on the water. The warming of the water won't have any effect on it.
That's not true.
I know.
Studies that have been made, some of my kids even made studies in the laboratory, and definitely did.
We have an anti-pollution made them fighting this stuff. Amazing, no?
This isn't true. All our evidence indicates specifically that it will increase the life cycle, it will result in reduced oxygen, and when the organisms need more, there is less. And water is over 90 degrees Fahrenheit will definitely result in death, though. You couldn't live in there for very long either, when you consider. But not fish, however. Yeah, actually, it can. Other problems too. You get more algae, and then you might get algal blooms, and again, problems. Or bacteria. Certain bacteria can tolerate these higher temperatures. But again, it's an artificial thing that we're creating, which can imbalance again. Another thing: are we variable enough? Are the organisms variable enough to adapt to our rapidly changing environment? In the past, environment never changed this fast. It was a slow type of thing, and always there was this variability that enabled survival. But when we rapidly change the environment, rapidly wipe out species, then again there can be. So you can see how complex this whole thing is. It's not an easy solution, an easy answer. This is one of our problems. We think, well, why don't we take care of that and do this? But you have to weigh so many factors and consider what are all these particular interrelationships. And it's a really extremely complex thing that we're dealing with.
Do you know what the how many degrees the water temperature has raised in the past, let's say, 10 years compared to the...
You mean because of thermal pollution?
Because of the atomic plant?
I don't know, and I think it varies on different rivers. In other words, depending on how many power plants you have in these particular rivers, it will vary.
Because there was at the Long Beach Ecology Fair, there was a big thing on it, and they said that in the past 10 years, the water over the entire Earth has raised quite a large number of degrees.
No, I don't know that. We could certainly be in trouble, certainly, by increasing this kind of thing. Then you see all the problems are produced. We've got to figure out ways of cooling other than, just cooling by means of lakes and streams and cooling towers or some other types of things. So fundamentally, then, photosynthesis process is the basis of all life. And we've got to, in other words, if survival is to occur, you see it's got to. This is the one fundamental thing in this fact of the food chain, that we've got to have so many more green plants, to support this, and the factor of accumulation. Some of these things that just you don't get rid of. And we have to consider when we use things, what is the half-life for these particular things? How long are they going to be in the environment? And unfortunately, many of these things are used before we have enough time to find out what are some of the effects of them, what is actually going to happen. Yes?
You said a movie in the story, you said that animal life, like the rabbit,
yeah, this is a very interesting phenomenon, which man has sort of ignored or otherwise. But there, in all animal populations, there is a natural control for population because of this competition. In other words, when you reach a certain number, then the competition for food gets too great and you have mass death of a lot, or failure to, of those to survive, what happens? Your population declines. And again, then you see then because there are fewer rabbits eating the certain animal, then gradually you see then there's more food supply and then it will go up again. But it will always, I mean, it remains, you see it has a fluctuation type of thing like this. But nevertheless, it is within a balance and it hasn't been as man, which you see we've gone continually up and up increasing. And now we're reaching.
It isn't always food.
No, space, there are all these, right, many, many interacting things, but there has always been, even proximity apparently causes some tensions that reduce the production.
Anything ever been discovered about these lemons?
What, lemons?
Lemons. Well, has anyone ever looked into that? Yeah. I don't know why they do this. You know?
Yes, they have been studied, and there is one example where it isn't always food. There's some other factors coming into play, and one of them is population density.
Well, what did the studies reveal?
I can't cite the chapter. I read it quite a while ago.
I mean, what makes you do it?
Well, the population density probably, some of it's tied up with stress, hormonal, and otherwise. And you can give quite a few examples of this, you know, like, well, one recent characteristic, one typical example given recently, you can take a wild mouse and for certain strains of mice, and you can have a female bred, and within a few days, you bring in a foreign male, not in the same pen, but proximity to it, so that you may either smell it or something. She will abort. So we have things, mechanisms like this. I'm sorry to take up the chat.
One other thing I'd like to just bring out before I close, that normally we think of fire as being undesirable. But in some cases, this is more or less the plan of nature, that we do have fires, and we can call it the so-called ecology of fires. And rather interesting things happen sometimes when we upset this. And this has happened in some of the southwestern forests, in which predominantly ponderosa pine. Normally the forest should be rather park-like, with the few trees here and not much underbrush. And it's actually a very nice kind of forest to go through, because you don't have to climb over a lot of dead branches and trees and everything. You've got these few very tall trees and maybe few in between, and then a very nice park-like type of area. Well, within the few years in the past, now that we're starting this fire control program, we find that instead we've got real problems, and you've got areas in which, you know, the whole forest had been burned out. And what causes this? Apparently this area is a very dry area, dry and hot in the summer and fall, and there are frequent fires that would go through the area. However, if you have a fire every 3, 4 to 7 years, it means that the little trees, if this fire would come through, and the debris that you'd have here, it would burn fast. Not extremely hot, it would not destroy the bigger trees, it just clean out the underbrush, so to speak. Okay, we'd have these periodic fires, and every time you see, a certain height would get wiped out, but anything a little bigger than that. And generally, something like a 4 or 7 year cycle or 10 year cycle. Supposing now we prevent fires for 15 years, you know, big rigorous fire program, what do we have? Tremendous amount of underbrush, a lot of seedlings, and a lot of fuel, in other words. Then, okay, a fire gets started. What happens? It's an extremely hot fire because you've got a lot of fuel. You've had the 15 years of accumulating this stuff. What happens? Extremely hot fire, and it destroys the bigger trees, too. So in this instance, maybe it would be better not to tamper and allow the fires, or even have controlled fires going through to clean out this, so that you don't have a big one that destroys everything. Also, there are certain trees, pine trees, that will not
shed their seeds. In other words, the cones don't get open to release seeds until you have the heat of a fire. In other words, after a fire, certain trees will come up, and they will not reproduce unless you get this heat of a fire. Rather interesting. So some of these things that we consider harmful, in some respects, in nature, if nature is allowed to, you know, form its natural course, it will replenish itself. And the chaparral, which is the type of vegetation we have in California, normally there would be a fire, generally about 7 to 10 years or so, and the chaparral can completely build itself up in 7 to 10 years to about 20 years.
What is the name of the tree near Carmel by the sea, the artistic tree?
Monterey cypress. Monterey cypress would be it, yeah. Which is an interesting tree too, that this one can tolerate the sea spray. Most other trees would are killed by salt, but this one can tolerate it and survives. Okay, I think I'll close off now, and if you have any other questions, this will give you a sort of a chance to stand up and stretch your legs and move around before the next lecture.